Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Material Matters with Grant Gibson. I've done well over 100 shows now. However, for listeners who might be new to all this, the idea is I speak to a designer, maker, artist or architect about a material or technique with which they're intrinsically linked and discover how it changed their lives and careers. Today, I'm delighted to be talking to Dutch designer Sanne Visser. London-based Sanne describes herself as a material explorer, maker and researcher, who's best known for a string of installations and products using human hair. Since graduating from Central St Martins a little under a decade ago, she has exhibited all over the world and been nominated for a number of awards. She will be one of the stars of this year's Material Matters Fair, which takes place at Barge House, Oxo Tower Wharf from the 18th to the 21st of September, with an installation supported by the Embassy of the Kingdom of the Netherlands called Locally Grown, that invites visitors to explore their hair as a new material. I've got to be honest, it's something I'm really looking forward to. Sanne, thank you so much for doing this. How the devil are you?
I'm very good, thank you.
Good.
Thank you for inviting me. It's very exciting.
Oh, that's my pleasure. Was all that reasonably accurate?
Yeah, that sounds pretty accurate. Yes, thank you.
Good, good. We have a tradition on this show of asking guests kind of where they work and also getting them to describe their studio. I mean, I can see you on our virtual studio that we have, but you're not giving too much away in the background. Where do you work and how do you work?
Good question. I work mainly from home. So I'm in my home studio now, which I meant to share with my partner, but it's kind of taken over by myself.
Okay, so you've dominated the space, in other words. This is what you're saying. We're getting into your domestic setup.
Yeah, yeah. It's a real privilege now to have a dedicated space to actually do a lot of making, much more research, and have an outdoor space as well. So it's where the sort of more messy making takes place. Yeah, since recently also working in Stratford alongside working at the university. So yeah. Majority working from home, but then you'll find me in different places.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we'll get into Stratford later, I suspect. But before that, I'm keen to talk about Material Matters, the fair that's happening this September, Oxo Tower Wharf at Barge House, 18th to 21st. You're exhibiting. You've got an installation that's going to be properly interactive. So what are you doing?
Yeah, it's going to be super interactive. Yeah, quite a playful, interactive exhibition installation. It's called Locally Grown. And it's kind of an evolution of some of the previous showcases I've done, but a more expansive version, I would say. And it's all about for people to understand and explore and very much physically experience what it means for human hair to become a material resource and actually really see the transformation that happens with hair going from fiber to products. Which is really exciting because for some people that know my work, it goes through various steps working with hair and people will be able to experience live haircuts, but also seeing spinners and rope makers and really understanding what it means through these different processes and how it really gets from fiber to product.
So essentially, a visitor will be able to come, have a free haircut. This is my understanding, Sanne. Have a free haircut and then possibly watch their hair being spun. And then if they hang around long enough, see that hair being turned into rope all in one space.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think it's really important for people to understand what the value is of their own materials, but also to understand what actually, how beautiful and precious that is and kind of what goes into the making. I think often with these design fairs and shows, we do see these beautiful handcrafted objects. But I think what often goes unseen is the makers behind it and the sort of more laborious processes which make all these beautiful products. So I think that is as much, if not more, important about it. And with this material, it obviously raises a lot of questions as well about. Often people ask me, where does the material come from? How do you make it? And these kind of key questions become immediately very clear and it becomes in a much sort of, it puts in a very different light than you would, yeah, otherwise see it when you just hear the story.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. And as you were alluding to, I mean, you've done in the past a residency at the London Design Museum. There was an installation a few years ago in Milan, again, entitled Locally Grown. I think you did something with Designer's Block way back in 2016. So is this a combination or a culmination even of years of research?
Yeah, I would say so. It's definitely a combination. It might be a better word. It is how it comes all together. Then the innovative processes that happens with the hair is really important. But then it isn't just about the material. And the more I've been researching this since the last few years, starting my PhD in 2020, is it's become much more systemic and holistic of how this material is used. And rather than just taking the material and turning it into these like interesting materials and products to use, it's actually raising a lot more questions about lots of other things. And that's where, with my residency at the Design Museum, I started to ask these questions about like, what is the role of the hairdressers actually in this scenario, and how are they affected by this potentially new, revolutionized material, and lots of other questions that kind of come with that about ethics or ownership or processes and transparency. And it's quite interesting to reflect back on how it's kind of evolved. And yes, the hair thing is still the same in that sense, like it's always driven by hair, but I think it's opened up a lot more questions.
Which I suspect we'll get into, because in the meanwhile, you also have a project happening in the London borough of Newham, which is in the east of the city. What are you doing there?
So in Newham, we have started setting up a pilot study, which is funded by the AHRC through UKRI as part of the Future Observatory programme with the Design Museum. And I work for UEL to set up this project, and we're working in partnership with Newham Council. And the idea with Hair Cycle, that's the name of the project, is that we're really looking at what kind of local circular models and methods can be utilized and developed to actually set this up, this idea of like hair recycling on this specific scale within a borough, within a London borough. And how does that look like, and how do we do that?
So what does that look like, and how are you doing it?
It's really interesting, and it's working extremely collaborative and open. And often I work on my own, but then I work with a lot of different collaborators. And then this way it's slightly different, because you work within a large institution with another large institution on the scale of a borough, which is very different than working in your own design studio making with hair, basically. And here we're actually looking much more into the infrastructure around waste and recycling, but also around behavior change towards waste and recycling, and what does that mean, but also around the meaning of hair from different perspectives, from different communities, groups.
That sounds interesting. I need to pick up on that before you go. The meaning of hair for different communities. That's really intriguing. What does hair mean for different communities?
Hair carries a lot of different meanings for different communities, depending on your background, your belief system, or your value system. And I think I've always respected that and kind of had that in the back of my mind when I've been researching or working with hair and collecting hair from different hairdressers and different people. But I think when working in Newham, which is a really highly diverse community with lots of different ethnicities and backgrounds and beliefs, it's not common for everyone to think that hair is just a waste and can be a resource. For many different people, it's actually a much more precious material that you wouldn't really want other people for it to be touched, or it actually goes much more deeply into like historical events, or people actually being quite concerned of what happens to their hair, especially if you're from Black Afro-Caribbean backgrounds. It's like it's really sensitive, so you have to really be mindful about what the response might be if you are going to collect the hair, and what people might think. What are you going to do with it, and how are you going to do that, and for what means? So in our approach, it's really important that we are very open about what we do and why we do it, and also really welcoming about other approaches and kind of involving the communities in designing these kind of new models and systems. So actually by organizing these kind of workshops where we invite the local community, whether they're residents or hairdressers or barbers and local council officers, so you have all these kind of like different people within the same room and questioning and asking people and having a really nice conversation about, yeah, what do you think of hair as a material, and how would you see this in a future system, and how would you, and not just as a sort of material design material, but also thinking about, okay, what if this becomes quite a sort of more commercially viable material? How is the financial system? How does that work? And how do you avoid, people being exploited? Or I don't know, there's lots of different things to think about. So it's actually, yeah, questioning the current infrastructure around waste and recycling. So rather than just taking the hair, processing it somewhere else and making beautiful things, it's actually thinking about how do we take that hair even, and what pressure is put on the people that are having to sort it for you or separate it, and how does it eventually get back to them? It's being really conscious about each step in the process, basically, and not just thinking about the design of the new object.
It's complex. I mean, when you're doing these community workshops, do you get surprising reactions, responses that you weren't expecting?
Yeah. Like, I think there is always surprising responses, but I think there is also often a common thread where people are concerned about very similar things, which I think is really interesting. People are often concerned about, yeah, the ethical process of how and where do you get the hair from? And then secondly, how, is it clean? Like the hygiene around it is often being questioned, which is really fair. And then what's being made from it. But I think it's often the questions that I believe should be asked about any material that we use for anything. And I think it just highlights that we aren't really aware or being educated where our materials are coming from. So I think I always see hair as a great way of bouncing back those questions of, we don't really know where our current waste goes or where our current materials are coming from. And it's asking the same questions about other things.
So hair can open up a wider debate about materials in general.
Yeah. That's what I think.
Yeah. It's quite interesting. The UK alone creates apparently 6.8 million kilograms of human hair waste annually. I mean, I don't know who measures that, but it's quite an intriguing figure. So generally speaking, Sani, what happens to that hair? What happens to our hair after we've been to the hairdressers?
Currently, it goes to landfill. It doesn't actually, it gets recycled or composted, which can be quite problematic because, it takes up space, it's sent to landfill, and it can't really biodegrade because it doesn't have the nutrients to break down. So, yeah, ideally that wouldn't happen. Yeah, it doesn't get recycled nor composted, which is, not a great thing. And at the same time, it could easily be used for a range of different things.
Mm. And can we talk a little bit about the qualities that human hair possesses? I mean, when you're using it, what particular qualities does it have?
Well, it's natural, which is great because it can naturally biodegrade. It's quite an interesting material, actually, because it can last up to 6,000 years if you keep it in the right conditions. And at the same time, it can be industrially composted within 6 weeks. So it's quite an interesting sort of longevity in that sense. It's also very lightweight. It's very strong. That's kind of the main characteristic that I've been always really intrigued by. And then it's got a range of other quite interesting characteristics to it. It's quite elastic. It's good in oil absorbing.
Well, yes, that was something I was going to talk to you about. One of the favorite things that I learned when I was doing a bit of research before we talked is there's a company in San Francisco called Matter of Trust that uses human hair to adsorb, which means to hold molecules as a thin film on the outside of a surface, and to adsorb oil. So if you have an oil tanker spilling oil, don't call Red Adair, that's showing my age, don't call Red Adair, but use human hair, which is really intriguing.
Yeah, that definitely piqued my interest at the time that I did my MA. The works by Matter of Trust, and interestingly, it's kind of spread across the world now with loads of different nonprofits and organizations using this technique where you can absorb the oil from waterways. So different organizations have been testing it in by coastal regions, but also by waterways, or even within cities with drainage, in airports or different kinds of, more urban environments. It's really interesting. I do think I'm going to be critical about it too.
Okay, go on.
I guess maybe that's what I would naturally be drawn to. It's good to see that hair is being used for something and also to kind of like take away what shouldn't be there. And it draws the general public in really easily to understand of like, actually, our hair can be used to mop up oil, which is amazing. At the same time, mopping up oil is also something we shouldn't have to be doing in the first place. And secondly, it could be also a great way for a lot of organizations to kind of jump on that and kind of make sure that that gets rid of. Also for the general public, it's much more easier to understand how like that relates to the climate, whereas some of the other applications might not come immediately to mind if you would say we can make textiles or we can make building materials with it, which is a sort of more positive enforcement of like trying to think of more environmental ways of using the hair. So in terms of like circularity, it's actually quite a sort of low valued application. And it's not a sort of like thinking about like the sort of highest value you can use the hair for in like a multitude of ways. And whereas, yeah, the oil absorbing is actually kind of at the end of its life, you might use the hair for, whereas in my opinion, a lot more interesting ways that we can use the hair first before it becomes an oil absorbent.
So that's a criticism of the media, really. I shouldn't be fascinated by that as a fact, is what you're saying, fundamentally.
Well, to be honest, I was drawn by this too for a long time. And I thought, actually, what I find really fascinating about it in many ways is understanding the material from like the material characteristics and really reading what the material can do. And based on that, understanding how it can be applied. And from that perspective, I think it's really fascinating. So in some ways, knowing this research, it has affected some of the things that we're doing now as well with the research actually as part of the new project. We're working with an organization called Rurban in Tower Hamlets. And we've actually, since last week, just started testing some of the hair for the grease water system to actually, in their garden, there's a clean water system where they reuse the water from the kitchen and how it can actually be clean to then water the garden again. We're actually using the hair to then clean the water as a water filtration to then water the garden again. So in many ways, we still use that existing research in that way.
Yeah, no, interesting. I mean, obviously, other qualities, I guess, is that as we've discovered, there's a lot of it. You don't need extra land, water, or energy to grow it, fairly obviously. And in terms of the strength, I was really intrigued that statistically, an average strand of human hair can hold up to 100 grams of weight, which is quite a fascinating thing for a designer to work with, I imagine.
Yeah, definitely. I was really drawn by that. I thought hair is incredibly strong and like, how can we utilize that to the most? So I did do some different hair strand testing and it's correct. Mm. You can use quite a lot of weight to test the hair strength. But from that moment on, I started really emphasizing the strength of the hair and exploring ways that the hair could be made into something that then can hold weight or kind of emphasize in that weight. And this was during my master degree where I really focused on the tensile strength of the material and was wanting to make rope from it.
Yes, it's interesting because the way that you work the material involves so many facets of design that you've kind of already alluded to, but I think it's worth just focusing in on it in a bit more detail because there's making and craft and spinning and turning the material into rope. There's also system design. In other words, working out how you retrieve the hair. Let's unpick that a little bit. First of all, when you're making the products that you've worked with traditionally, and this is before the new project that we've touched on, where does the hair come from? How did you retrieve it in the first instance?
So in the beginning as well, I approached hairdressers to collect the hair. Though I wasn't focused at all on how I was going to get it. I had a lot of doubts myself of how I'm going to get it from the hairdressers. What if they don't give it to me? So I did get it from hair salons and barbershops, which was a lot harder in the beginning because I didn't have any samples to show what I was going to do with it. So I looked a bit more like a lost artist, I think, at the time for a lot of people. And that's not a really confident way to try and convince people that it's going to be really, really a good material. So it's also shown me along the way how important it actually is to show those stakeholders as well. Like, what do you do with the hair? And as soon as you show people what you can do with their hair, people are like absolutely amazed.
So how did you persuade the first hairdresser to let them give you their waste hair?
I think still by telling them what an incredible material this could be and how we could utilize it and it not going to waste. And the other thing for some people, it literally didn't matter whether it was going to the bin or whether I was going to pick it up. I still think, especially in the beginning, there had to be a level of trust to know who are you, what are you going to do, what is your intention with it, and making sure that you are genuinely saying what you're going to do with it. And I think I've always valued that part of it, and then going back to actually showcase what it is that I was trying to do at the time. Not to say that all the people are interested in that, but I think it's just making sure that you are genuine.
No, absolutely. So once you've persuaded the hairdressers in question to give you their hair, what did you do with it? How do you work it?
In the beginning, it was really tricky, actually, because I wasn't quite sure. I'm not from a textile background, so I didn't have any technical knowledge of how I was going to turn this into rope. And quickly, I think I tried some different techniques of making it into dreads first and then like dreadlocks and then trying to twist it, which didn't work at all. Like, it didn't look very good. It didn't work. And quickly I realized I need to find a spinner to make yarn. And that was then the kind of next step of like where I was going to find a spinner. And thankfully through the materials library at Central St. Martin's, I got a contact there from a spinner in Sheffield, who I reached out to and see if she was interested to work with me on this. And she was.
And did she need much persuasion?
No, which was really great.
Yeah, it's quite intriguing.
Exactly. No, she had been spinning for like 20 years with different kinds of fibers and never with hair, but was totally up for the challenge. And we did some samples and they came out great. Because the other thing is you can... like longer strands are really easier, not too long, but like longer strands of hair. But the whole aim for me was what was really important to make the point is actually to work with short fibers, which is where the kind of more challenging part lies. And so we were able to spin the hair from around minimum of 3 to 4 centimeters and longer. And she was able to do that. So I was really, really happy and pleased that we could tackle the short hair waist and not like extension long hair kind of thing.
So you found a spinner. It was always going to be rope that you wanted to make.
Yeah, quite quickly, I think. I first explored some other techniques of felting and some with bioplastics, but quickly it just didn't do the things that I wanted to do. And with the course lead at the time, Kieran Jones, we had many different discussions around what I wanted to focus on, and the tensile strength was definitely leading to the rope idea, because rope was holding weight, so it totally made sense to make rope. And what was fascinating about rope making to me was that technique is, in a way, it's so ancient, it's like really, really old. And what's interesting with rope is that you don't have to add any binders or additional materials, whereas the other techniques that I looked at, like making a composite, it always required another material. Whereas with rope, if I managed to get the short fibers to twist together, then it could be 100% a human hair material. And that was actually quite important for me. And still to today, I find that quite sort of high value that it doesn't need any other material, because that adds a whole array of questions of where does that other material then come from.
Because the notion of going back to a traditional craft, was that important to you? I mean, it seems to me that you weren't trying to reinvent everything. There was a place in your world for techniques that some people would describe as heritage, I guess.
Exactly. I was definitely drawn to craft. And I think that that must have already kind of like been like that for a while as being a creative. And I thought that was so much existing and interesting knowledge in those particular crafts, especially rope making. And it hadn't been looked at so much around me. And it was also therefore quite hard to find information and people with the experts in rope making. It was actually quite tricky. Through a bit of YouTube, I could find a little bit, but not as much in rope making. It's more knot work. And because rope making itself is now pretty much fully industrialized. And so I had to then find a rope maker that could then teach me, the tricks of how do we make rope.
Yeah.
And I did, which was really exciting.
Hope you're enjoying the show so far. This is just to remind you that the Material Matters Fair runs from the 18th to the 21st of September at Barge House, Oxo Tower Wharf. There's going to be loads to see. As we've heard, Sané will be there, and she will be joined by, among other things, an installation on the future of textiles from Biotech's Future. Studio Tip will be using construction waste to transform our entrance space. Transport expert Priestman Good is our design studio of the year. Hydro will be doing amazing things with scrap aluminium. Corian will be there. And look out for a collaboration between architect and designer T.P. Bennett and the Furniture Practice that investigates how materials are affecting the contract design world, with brands including Mark & Bisley, Modus, Florim, Norman Copenhagen, Reddy, Suru, and many, many more. There'll be designers and makers working everything from roots and recycled ceramics to mycelium and food waste. Oh, and there'll be talks there too, with the likes of Mark Miodovnik, Caroline Teal, and Jonathan Smales of the podcast, and loads of others, in a space created with our official acoustic partner, Woven Image. It's all very exciting. The event is free for trade, but you must, and I repeat, you must, register in advance. The link is in the show notes. See you soon. One of the things that's happened over the years is that you've kind of designed and made your own tools to work with the material.
Yeah, that came at the back of that process because there was so little out there in terms, especially rope making, but also spinning. It was such a tricky field and not as many experts that I could reach out to that I felt like actually this needs to be much bigger. Like as soon as we make this more accessible and more open access and get people to get hands on with these techniques, we can become a bit more self-sufficient in that way. Well, it was also a bit of a selfish part because for me, it was quite tricky to do it only relying on other people to do it. There's not like existing rope machines on the shelves in every shop. So for me, it was actually a bit of a barrier of like, how am I going to make more rope if I don't have a machine and I can't buy it? That's kind of the only way of like, I'm going to have to make a machine. I'm quite hands-on and I quite like being hands-on. So that quickly came after my MA that I was quite intrigued by making tools and machines, that I make my own rope machine based on the existing technique. So it was, again, not really reinventing the machine itself, but more a sort of modernized version that is a bit more easy to fold. The first version was a bit more low-key. The second version was more intended and designed for it to be open source and designed for a more flat pack design. So that's when the second rope machine that I made together with two engineers, and it made it much more easy for myself to make the rope, but I also really intended it to be for other people to learn the skill.
Interesting. I mean, the other thing you've talked about is hair getting contaminated in the collection process. I mean, is that when it falls on the floor? How does it get contaminated?
Yeah, it's mainly when it falls on the floor. Hair in itself isn't actually a very dirty material if you would compare it to a lot of other natural fibers like sheep's wool or other plant fibers that require much more processing. But hair, interestingly, not as much men's cuts, but lots of female cuts, before you cut it, you get it washed, you get it cut, and then it drops on the floor and then it gets swept in the bin. And what I was finding during the residency in the design museum is actually it gets swept on the floor, but it's already been washed and then it has to be washed again, which makes no sense. So actually, how can we avoid that double process and avoid it being contaminated? And that's kind of where my more latest project then came alive.
Well, you designed your own barber's chair.
Yeah, exactly. So that's when the barber's chair came about, and a gown that also catches hair, and then the barber's chair would catch hair as you get it cut to kind of, get it, avoid it from falling on the floor. So avoid it from getting contaminated, but also avoid it from putting less pressure and stress on the hairdresser and barber to like sort it, separate it.
So how does that chair differ from a conventional barber's chair?
It's a bit more prototype, but the idea would be that as soon as you get it cut, there's like a bag, a collection bag at the back of the chair, as well as at the bottom of the chair, even in the chair. I've worked together with an upholsterer for that project and it was really exciting. We basically tried to see how we can alter an existing secondhand chair, barber's chair, to catch the hair as you get it cut. So it has sort of collection holes in there. Middle of the chair, which then the hair drops into, as well as the back of the chair. And the idea is that the hair recycler basically just replaces the bottom of the bag with a new bag, and it's kind of convenient for both the recycler as well as for the hairdresser and barber.
Very good. Okay, we've got to the point where we've worked out how you collect the hair, we've worked out how you make the rope. What products have you created with the material and why?
I created a range of different objects, and in the beginning I've created different bags, so netted bags, belts, dock leads, which are all a bit more utilitarian and more sort of practical, and that was very intentional. That was for my MA project, and I wanted to show more the practicalities of rope and how it could be handcrafted and kind of beautifully made as well as really practical. And for me that was quite sort of a way of convincing people as well of like seeing the material as not as something disgusted, but actually something really strong and really like you can use it. It's actually really strong. And over the years, I've been very interested in making also objects that are quite interactive. So in 2017, I think, I developed a swing. So I made a swing where you can actually swing on, which again was really intended for it to be used and like feel it and experience it, where people can actually feel and see that it's a strong material.
The one that I'm most fascinated by is the bungee cord that you made. Has anybody used this to bungee jump with?
No, absolutely not. Okay. But I say this, it's going to be on Dutch TV soon, which is quite exciting. We made a rope for an interesting Dutch kids TV show where the presenters are going to abseil from a castle from quite high, from the fully 100% human hair rope. So it's not bungee cording, but it's abseiling, which I think comes pretty close.
Yeah. I mean, yes, it's a drop, whichever way.
Exactly.
This is quite intriguing. And was it important to you that the material had a function beyond, people know that hair extensions are made from human hair? I mean, you're not making pieces of art here, for example. I know at the moment in the Hayward in London, Tavares Strachan is showing pieces that use human hair because throughout the slave trade, it was used as a tool of resistance, concealing objects or coded messages in patterned braids. But your objectives were very different.
Yeah, they weren't necessarily to be art objects, but obviously they've been also shown in different cultural institutions and in museums. And I think it's a great way of still learning about it and kind of sending a message across. So I guess in that same way, it is an art object because it does similar things, because it's trying to tell a message. But I do think it does go, I guess, where it sort of segues from art is where I do want it for people to be used and kind of like embedded and being practical as well as being that storytelling object as well as being aesthetically pleasing. So I guess I'm trying a lot in one bit, but I think I like it when it does get used and actually handled.
And collaboration, This seems to be absolutely vital to what you do. I mean, we've talked during this conversation of collaboration with local communities, with hairdressers, but you've also worked with scientists and anthropologists as well.
Yeah, collaboration is key to everything I do. I work quite independent, but I would never say I work alone. Work with different scientists, which I think you need these kind of different disciplines and these quite varied fields to be able to understand particularly this material. But again, I think it draws back to lots of different materials to be able to understand how you would actually work with it and then implement it, because you need those different knowledges and perspectives on a different material. And I think this field of inter-transdisciplinary is really important, where you work and learn from other disciplines, but also can kind of exchange different ways of working and methods as well. Whereas, when you work with a scientist, it's very different than working with a hairdresser, or it's very different with a local council officer. So I think it does really test the boundaries of yourself as a person as well, of like you have to be extremely open-minded, quite, I guess, vulnerable in some ways and in adaptive in many ways as well, because your language just changes anytime you speak to different audiences or collaborate with different people. Your approaches and your methods become quite different too. Whereas, if you would work in your own bubble, you might not have to kind of adapt in that way.
So how would your language differ, I wonder, from talking to a hairdresser to a scientist?
Well, the sort of aims for a scientist is quite different, or like the concerns or challenges or interests even are quite different, where a scientist really wants to know, like, yeah, if we want to, let's say, dissolve hair for to make a bioplastic, your conversations are very technical and do contain a certain academic language that I wouldn't by nowhere near use in the same to, let's say, a hairdresser who doesn't sometimes necessarily know what it means to have a sustainable material, or at least not in that same meaning, even though if you break it down into the same language, people would understand exactly the same meaning of the same topic, but explained in very different ways. And also the interests are just different for different people. So something that a scientist might be very interested in is totally not of interest for a hairdresser. So you might not explain the full story. Well, you would always explain the full story as much like to gain the integrity. But yeah, you also have to understand that some people are not going to be interested in what you're doing at all. And other people might be.
Are there difficulties in working with human hair?
You mean on the technical side? Yeah.
Yeah. Is it difficult? Is it more difficult, I don't know, than, say, wool?
Yeah. It's got definitely its challenges. For example, yeah, and even like sort of more technical, like if you're more in the textile industry and work with hair for the first time, you definitely would say that hair is actually quite a sort of slippery material. It's quite silky. But at the same time, it's also quite thick compared to like other fibers, especially when you're looking in a textile field where if you use different wools to make certain kinds of textiles for clothing, you need quite a fine wool for it to be wearable. Whereas hair is actually so much thicker if you would look under the microscope, and it also looks very different under the microscope compared to like other kinds of fibers. It's not as spiky as other fibers would be. So it doesn't really attach to itself as wool, for example, would, which makes that process a lot harder with spinning. So spinning technique is also, again, very ancient, but extremely helpful. And it's how we actually make yarn and clothing or textiles for interiors. And hair is actually it can be quite tricky to spin because it doesn't have that kind of fuzziness, and it's therefore a bit trickier to twist.
And in the same way that different sheep have different wool that's used for different things, presumably we do have different hair. Afro-Caribbean person's hair is different from an Asian person's hair. It's different from a Caucasian person's hair. Do they have different qualities and different uses, therefore?
They do have different qualities and they do have different shapes. So again, if you would, obviously you visually see that different people have different hairs, but even again, if you look under the microscope, you see even the different shapes and the different structures to it. So it does definitely impact. For example, Asian hair grows on average much faster than some of the other backgrounds and ethnicities.
15 centimetres a year, according to my research.
Exactly. It's very interesting. And for example, more often Asian hair is also stronger than some of the other hair types. But again, it's all on average and it's all also based on lots of other factors that have an influence on the health of your hair. So it is something that I was quite drawn to during my MA as well, about like how can we actually use these different hair types for different purposes. At the time, because I was so focused on tensile strength, I predominantly focused also on using Asian hair to emphasize the fact that hair has different kinds of qualities from different backgrounds. I've kind of let that go a little bit, or like not as emphasized enough, even though what I do want to emphasize, what I think is really beautiful about the different hair types and the naturalness of like different people's hair, is that obviously in different plant-based fibers or animal fibers is that there's differences. But I think it's what's interesting with human hair is that you have this huge array of like different shapes, whereas from curly to wavy to straight, but also these different natural colors. And actually, how can we start to emphasize that more rather than going with the same, what we've been trying to do within our current societies, to try and hide the gray hairs or like straight and curly hair, whereas actually, no, like how can we make sure that we emphasize how beautiful this natural occurrence is?
Absolutely. I find going to the barber incredibly traumatic nowadays at my age. I mean, I always do the thing where I say, just cut out the grey, cover the bald. And as one barber pointed out to me, that is now, and I won't use the language they used to me, but it's very, very difficult to do that. Is there a hair community? Are there lots of designers and makers working in hair? Do you gather to discuss the qualities and what you're up to? I know Studio Swine back in the day, a few years ago, were working with human hair to create products. I think their practice has gone in a slightly different direction. But are there others that you communicate with?
Yeah, there's more and more designers and artists working with hair, which I think is really fascinating. And it really does show that hair is becoming more popular, which I think is a great thing, because that means that the more people are working with it, the more likely other people might start to accept it as part of the materials palette in a way, and it becomes more accessible for other people to work with. I've worked and I've spoken to quite a few different organisations, including the Matter of Trust or the different organisations in the UK, different designers in the Netherlands, as well as an organisation in France. So yeah, it's really interesting to connect and stay connected with some of those more small independent organisations focused on, for example, the oil absorbent mats. So yeah, it's fascinating to keep being in touch with those people and grow the network in that way.
Yeah, yeah. Can we talk about your background, Sanne? I mean, you're from the Netherlands originally. Were you always going to be a designer?
I was always going to be a creative, let's say it like that.
Right.
Okay. That's for sure. Whether I would have called it a designer, I don't know. But I've also never liked the word artist. I think I've just always been drawn, I want to make and create. And that was definitely since I was very little on the cards.
Right. What did your parents do?
My parents, they are also creative, but my parents owned for a long time a landscape and gardening company.
Okay.
So yeah, I grew up in quite a big house with a large plot of land with a big greenhouse where, yeah, me and my sister always just, yeah, rummaged around with my grandparents and just, yeah, played with the mud and the plants, which was great.
So you're playing with mud and plants, but were you making other things from a young age?
Yeah, definitely. I was very into making and creating and crafting, and my mum and my dad were very motivating for that too. My mum is a ceramicist, and so that's definitely where the creative side falls into. But yeah, from a very young age, I was very dedicated that I wanted to go to art school, and I wanted to shake the world for that to happen for sure. But yeah, I didn't have really high grades in my high school, so I had to work a bit harder to be able to get into art school, but I made it happen. And then yeah, and then I got accepted, but I was too young, so they kind of sent me off for another year.
What did you do in that year?
I went to the US for an exchange, which was really interesting. I really enjoyed it. I don't think I would have picked the US again if I was a bit older, but I think it was a really great experience. I learned English, and it was, it was really good. And then I came back and I was really excited to do art school.
Because initially you studied lifestyle and design.
Yeah.
In Rotterdam. Lifestyle and design, I'm kind of intrigued by that. What did that encompass?
Yeah, I agree that the title isn't super explanatory. It meant a lot of things, actually. And it's quite hard to describe, but we learned things around how, from trend forecasting to photography to a little bit of product design, but there wasn't a huge amount on it. There was quite a bit of branding and graphic design. So I think it was very much a sort of quite a holistic approach of different kinds of styling and kind of art direction types. So I think quite a few people that graduated from there went to like work for magazines or trend forecasting agencies.
And when did the interest in materials begin in that case? Did it start on that course?
Yeah, it definitely started on that course. Predominantly during my last year though, which is a bit of a regret. I think in the first 3 years of my BA, I didn't actually get super hands-on, I think, as I could have. I think there was still this kind of being afraid of being in the workshops and just fully go wild, whereas I kind of got more the hang of that in the last year. And yeah, I just loved playing with materials, and I kind of claimed a part in the greenhouse at my parents to play with materials and make my final year project, which also already included hair, actually.
Oh.
But not as deliberate.
Okay, so how were you working with hair in that case?
I worked with a different range of natural materials, sheep's wool, also bacteria, which it wasn't actually as popular at the time, but I was already working with different material, bacteria, mycelium, waste denim fibers, hemp fibers, and I kind of, it was much more of an artistic sort of fine arts project, where, yeah, I kind of made this installation of 50 material samples all in different shapes and colors and textures. And it was very much about, I think the topic was around authenticity and how different materials change shape over time through natural occurrences, and documented that. But yeah, the hair didn't really have a sort of central role. It was more, I was being quite intrigued by it.
And was it always going to be then that you were going to come to London to the Material Futures course?
Yeah, I'd seen the previous degree show and I was really fascinated by the final year work. And I started following Caroline Till's work and I was just really fascinated about what the students were developing and what the course would offer. I didn't have any idea that I wanted to go to London at all. Like, I was extremely happy in Rotterdam. I did not need to move, in my opinion, but I was really determined to then apply for the course. So I did apply for Material Futures and got accepted. So then I was like, well, I'm just going to do the course and then come back and it's going to be fine.
I mean, you mentioned Caroline, who's been on the podcast, but she wasn't running the course at that stage, or was she still there?
She was still there, but she just gone on maternity leave during my final year.
Ah, okay. And so when did hair become a thing? Presumably you didn't arrive and decide immediately it's going to be human hair for me. When did you decide that that was the material of choice?
Quite quickly. I was really intrigued by hair. I started to look into it more and understanding what the qualities were and like started to understand what the quantities and the qualities were. And I had seen other people doing projects where you would pick a material and fully explore that to like just really kind of exploit the material in that way. And that's what I've had my head on of like, I want to work with hair. I don't know what I'm going to do with it yet, but that's what I want to do.
Was there a moment? Can you remember a moment where you decided, yeah, I've got to work with hair?
Maybe not one moment. I think it was just this nagging thing in the back of my head that I knew that human hair was intriguing. I wasn't so aware of sort of like me wanting to be the designer that creates change for the environment as much during my BA, but during my MA, it was really like, we have a responsibility here. I think human hair can play a role in this field and there is a lot of it. And I think... yeah, I think there is much more in this, even though there are some designers that have looked at it and including Studio Swine. And I think that project was definitely part of, yeah, the inspiration for me too. Just to rethink materiality in that way. And I think, in my opinion, human hair wasn't sort of explored enough. And I thought that's my opportunity there.
And was it then always your intention to stay in London after the course?
I didn't think I would stay in London at all, but I did. I thought, you know, I'm going to stick around for a bit. I was quite happy with my final year. I was happy with working with hair. I thought, you know, I'm going to try and exhibit my work for a little bit more and see what happens. And that's when I actually exhibited my work for the first time during LDF at the Barch House 9 years ago now. But I also thought, if I can just find a job that's a making job, then I'll just see what happens for at least a year and then we'll find out. I then started a paid internship at Based Upon, which is a sort of more high-end luxury furniture design company, which I loved because I could then just full-time make in a workshop.
Well, they have a massive facility, huge. Don't they? I have been around their place and it's enormous and lots of people making extraordinary things.
Exactly. Yeah, I was really excited to be in a workshop full of other makers and I was just excited, just graduated. I didn't want to think about my project all the time. I just wanted to be making and get hands-on and feel like, oh, can I even get paid to do making job? That's incredible. It was a paid internship. And then I stayed there for, I think, 2 or 3 years, but I had to make a bit of a hard decision to leave a nice, in a way, comfortable job to have the financial security to make the harsh call to go freelance But then that gave me the flexibility and freedom to do my own work. Yeah, I was happy to make that sacrifice.
I mean, it is a harder route, I imagine, that you're taking this kind of research-led experimental material projects rather than, I don't know, making furniture for some Italian brand.
Yeah, no, it's 100% harder. And I think for some time it's been definitely quite struggling to do that kind of work and finance yourself. Like, I mean, I can't say enough like how much applications you have to put in to try and get funding for research or design work, the kind that I'm doing. So I think ever since I've graduated, it's been putting in applications for funding for the work that I do, which is hard. And I think that because I was so interested in research, I'm less in product design and selling products, because that was for a long time going really against from my own instincts, even though over time I've kind of learned to accept that that's part of it too. But the research part, and that's when I was so drawn to research, but didn't quite understand how I was going to fund that and where and how am I going to get supported. And actually then had a friend who studied marine biology, and she's like, you're already doing the research, you might as well do a PhD. And I never thought of doing a PhD. I didn't consider myself really being the right candidate for that kind of research. Maybe because I've never been really super excited about reading or writing. Dyslexic, not really good concentration for that, even though I've such a big fascination for doing research, but more practice-based research. And I didn't quite understand what that meant, and that there is actually a field out there for that. And you can do practice-based research within an arts institution. So that's when I started to look into it and actually, oh, this could be actually perfect for me. I can do a practice-based PhD. And that's where I then ended up applying for a practice-based PhD at UAL, and which I started in 2020. It wasn't an easy ride, because it's still at the time I thought I'm going to do a PhD, but only if it's funded, which the funding didn't come through. And COVID hit. I didn't have freelance jobs. I didn't have any finance. I was on universal credit. I was like, what am I doing? How am I going to do a PhD without funding and without income? And managed to get some other work in. Still accepted the PhD and thought, I'm going to make it work one way or another. And yeah, started the PhD, was really exciting. And then for 3 years in a row, still applying for funding, and the third time I got funding. So that was excellent.
Hurrah. And you teach as well, Sané, right?
Yes, I teach as well on a few different courses, which is really exciting.
Does that bring something? Does that enhance your own research and practice?
Yeah, it just puts it in perspective. Again, I never thought I would be teaching at all, because I had this picture in my head always when I was young that teaching is awful and you're going to get bullied or something. Whereas I never considered teaching on higher education, which is a whole different ballgame. It's more about knowledge exchange and more about passing on the knowledge you've already gained to other people in a different way. But yeah, I think, and I teach on different courses. I teach both on textile design and on the new course called Communicating Complexity, which says it on the tin. It falls within the graphic design department. But yeah, I think it's more about systems thinking and understanding how you actually communicate very complex topics and ideas. Yeah, it's a really interesting course. But yeah, I think definitely teaching on the different courses has helped me in my own practice and development.
Our time, our hour or so, is nearly up. So I'm intrigued, or I'm really interested in what your plans for the future might be. I mean, obviously you have the Newham project, which is ongoing. You have the Material Matters Fair, very importantly, 18th to 21st, which is coming up. But subsequent to that, where might Hair take you?
It's a very good question. We will find out. No, I hope Hair is going to take me in different places, meeting lots of different people. And I really want to see how Hair is becoming a more valued material, where it's not just seen as like you can recycle it, but actually it can make quite larger changes in different ways, thinking about infrastructures to policies to behavior change to the way we view materials. So I really hope that I can continue the way I'm working now, but also making it more long-term and more long-lasting. All my work has been not just project-based only, but really trying to make it more long-term and impactful. And that's definitely what we're trying to do with Haircycle at the moment, of how can we pilot and envision this model now, but how can this actually continue to work, but also how can it become an example for different different areas and different locations.
Brilliant. Well, we look forward to that space opening up. Very good luck with Haircycle. I will see you very soon in September. And thank you so much for your time, Sanne. I really enjoyed that.
Thank you so much, Grant.
To find out more about Sanne, go to sannevisser.com. And remember, the Material Matters Fair runs from the 18th to the 21st of September at Barge House, Oxo Tower Wharf. Admission is free for trade, but you must register in advance. I'll put a link in the blurb that comes with this episode. As ever, to find other podcasts I've done and sign up to our newsletter, go to materialmatters.design. And there are images relating to the interviews on our Instagram page, which is also materialmatters.design. And it would make me incredibly happy if you went to my Patreon page and made a pledge at patreon.com/materialmatters. For as little as £2.50 a month, you can receive an invite to various Material Matters events, as well as getting access to each episode before it's published to the wider world. Material Matters is a completely independent concern, and any help you can offer would be hugely appreciated. Ultimately, you'll be helping to take the message of the importance of materials, skill, craft, and design to a whole new audience. Thanks very much for listening, and hope to see you soon.